It's time for my annual "Where Are You Going?" sermon. Usually when that question is asked, we say, well, I'm going to the feast, or a feast, the Feast of Tabernacles. But this, of course, I'm talking about it as a post-feast question. An annual sermon, "Where Are You Going?" I started this in 1998 in Northwest Indiana and continued it for about 9 or 10 years. Every year after the Feast of Tabernacles, I would give a sermon on goals and changes, developing your life, becoming better than you are. And they seem to get a lot from it. Some of you heard the one I gave last year, and you may say, oh, well, I've heard that before, not again. And I may have some things in this one that I had last year, but not all. Some may be happy, though, because as the lady who, and I'm sure she's heard something about financial management, something that I said got to her, and she was very grateful that now she had hope that she could have a balanced budget and she could enjoy her money rather than being always frightened that whatever she had would be taken from her. Maybe some will be happy now that they have learned that it can help them also in going forward in life. As a preliminary point about this sermon, consider this scenario. Your car is in the garage, and you go to the garage, get into the car, put the key into the ignition, or press the ignition button they have now, which is a new thing, but put the key in the ignition, start the car, then put the gear shift in reverse. And then you rev the gas pedal quite a lot, roar it up a little. And next, you take your hand off the wheel. You've put it in reverse. You've stepped on the gas pedal. You took your hand off the wheel. It's in reverse. You're in the garage. What do you think will happen? You may say, well, it depends on whether I'm driving the car or my wife is. But what do you think will happen if you've done all those things? You may or may not get out of the garage. The car may not. If it does, you may hit the garage door side going out. You may hit a child in the driveway, which has happened quite a few times over the last years. You may hit the post office box at the end of the driveway because it wasn't going straight. Or you may go all the way across the street and land on somebody's yard across the street. Or it may just completely stall. What are the chances that your car will, without your driving it, back out, turn properly, and go down the street properly? What are the chances of your car doing that? Well, I'd say slim and none. Slim and none. And why would that be? Well, it's a very good answer, and it's a strong, powerful answer, and it should help us in this matter of how to plan our life. Why will the car have no chance of going the way you want it to go? Because no one or nothing is guiding the activity of the car. And think of that for a moment and apply it to life as to whether we are truly guiding our life or just letting it run without anybody guiding it. You say, well, it's a good analogy. I understand it. You got your point across, but what's it got to do with life? Well, it has a lot to do with life. It has been estimated, and I've heard it said by quite a few people over the years, that only 5% of people in the USA have goals for their life. Well, that's awful. Yet I've been one of those 95% many years before that. Only 5% of people are actively guiding their lives. 95% are just idling their engine. But they're not getting anywhere, or not very much. Idling their engines, wondering why, at all the same time, wondering why they aren't going anywhere, why they're not accomplishing very much. Goals focus our attention on specifics. Let me say that again, because you may think, well, I don't need to have goals, but it is important. Goals focus our attention on specifics. And then, much more importantly, is by continually focusing our attention on a specific activity, we then have more of a chance of accomplishing it. Let's look in Proverbs 29. I don't remember if I gave this one last year or not, but it is an important one, and it'll always be an important one. It's just not a here today and gone tomorrow proverb. It is a forever proverb. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 18. It is one of those living laws that whether we believe it or not, we will be governed by it. Proverbs 29 and verse 18. The New King James translation of it is a little different from the Old King James. Where there is no revelation we think of Bible prophecy of gloom and doom, but revelation just means to reveal something as to what's going on. The Old King James said, where there is no vision, and we think of vision as being able to look into the future and see things happening. Where there is no vision or where there's no revelation, the people cast off restraint. The Old King James says, perish. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Or in other words, they cast off restraints, or they will not be guided. And if they're not guided, they may just perish, or they certainly won't succeed. I added one here. Where there is no vision, usually we come to embarrassing circumstances. If we don't watch what's happening, if we don't take advantage of what's happening, we may find ourselves in very, very embarrassing circumstances, and life then is not what we would like it to be. The next part of this, in the latter part of verse 18, says, but happy is the individual who keeps the law or lives by the law, who puts the law into activity in their life. The law, God's Ten Commandments, is a codified outline of activity. Worship the true God. Don't tell lies. Remember the Sabbath. Honor your parents. Don't commit adultery. And a lot of other things that help us to focus on how to have a successful life by living by those laws. And you don't have to pay the consequences of not doing it at all. Then there's another one in Proverbs 13, and I do believe I mentioned this one, if not in another sermon, but in Proverbs 13, this always brings back one of the TV sitcoms that used to be, I think it was Jackie Gleason many years ago. Proverbs 13 and verse 19 says, a desire accomplished. A goal is a desire, that is, I would like to do this. I would like to accomplish this. I desire to have this done. A desire accomplished or finished is sweet to the soul. Or as we say, and as Jackie Gleason was famous for saying, how sweet it is. Once you've done it, you have the reward coming your way. Life is better. There's just something inside that says, how sweet it is. You enjoy it. You can taste it because you did what you knew you should have done, and it is accomplishing something better in life. So, what would you like to accomplish or wish you could accomplish in this coming year? We usually have goals on January 1, but I placed it at the first Sabbath after the Feast of Tabernacles when we're planning our year. What would you like to change in the coming year if you could? Do you have specifics to accomplish this year that you would focus on? Why not? The year will come and go whether you do or not. You know that. It will come and it will go, even if you don't have specific items to work on. I've said many times, and I'm sure you've heard yourself say, where did it go? What happened? The years gone. What did I accomplish? Where did it go? Well, perhaps we don't have goals because, and I'll list a few things that are excuses that I give, you give, we all give, as to why we don't or won't. I think sometimes we think it has to be some huge accomplishment, this grandiose thing that puts others breathless when they see what we've accomplished. But that's not the key at all. Actually, in reality, a huge accomplishment is nothing more than a large number of small accomplishments linked together. That's all it is. Small accomplishments, little by little, that we link together. And after a while, we realize, hey, I really accomplished a lot here. God revealed this monumental principle long ago. But we catch on very slowly. At least I do. I don't know about you, but it takes me sometimes a long time to catch on. Let's look at this principle, and it is a monumentally important and powerful principle in Exodus 23 and verse 29. I think something that we should look at often in our private personal Bible study just to refresh it in our mind. It's one thing to hear it once, but it's another thing to think about it over and over again and see it with our eyes. Exodus 23 and verse 29, it was about God talking to the nation that he had chosen, Israel, about their getting into the promised land from Egypt to the land of milk and honey. And, of course, there were other people living there that they were expected to move out. And he said, I will not, and they were much larger, they were more powerful than Israel. So they were up against a wall. But they were expected to go there. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year or a short time. A quick fix. No, it won't be a quick fix. It won't be a short time. It may take a long time. He said, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous from you. In other words, there would be... What he's saying is, I'm doing it over the long haul because I know it's going to take you a while to come up to snuff, as we use the expression, to become able to assimilate this growth and let it be you so that it is you and you act that way, you think that way, and you now are that way. It will take time. He said in verse 30, little by little, not a huge, astronomically large accomplishment that would just wow everybody, but a little here, a little there over the long time, and we assimilate those changes, we're able to handle our growth. When I was in the 8th grade, I think I was 5'9". When I was in the 9th grade, I was 6'3". You know, I shot up and I was a little gawky. You see that in kids at times where they just kind of shoot up and they're gawky. They can't handle their own body as they ought to. They're a little awkward. Well, that's the way it is with us. If it's more than we can handle, we're a little awkward because we've never done that before. So God said, little by little. He does not expect us to accomplish it all immediately. He never has and he never will. He wants it to be sound and solid, and it actually builds us rather than sometimes even destroys us because we don't accomplish it. We get discouraged and we give up and quit. Another reason we don't have goals to overcome is, well, what I do won't be as much as someone else. I can't do what they can do. So what? So what if you can't do what I can do? So what if I can't do what you can do? I wasn't ashamed and embarrassed in one sense that I didn't know what Sid Loudon knew about the car. He helped me to get it running. That's the important thing. But sometimes we feel inferior and we don't want to admit that we feel inferior, so we just give up and quit. God looks at this differently. He does not judge us against each other. We are judged on our own. You'll find this in Matthew 25, beginning in verse 14, which shows the thoughtfulness, the consideration toward human beings based on who they are and what they are and what they can do. He asks for growth, change, and overcoming. But he doesn't have to say we each have to do what the other's doing, as much as that is. Matthew 25, beginning in verse 14. Matthew 25 and verse 14 says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country, called his own servants, delivered to them his goods. To one he gave 5 talents. Now notice the word talent is a monetary term. He's speaking of growth. He's speaking of conversion. He's speaking of spirituality. He's talking of conversion and producing results. And yet he used money as a type of it. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1. To each according to his own ability." He does not expect you to do what the other person does if the other person can do more than you can do. He expects us to do what we're capable of doing. How tall does a tree grow? You say, what do you mean? There are different sizes of trees. How tall does a tree grow? As tall as it can grow. That's it. As tall as it can grow. Depending on circumstances, it may grow a little taller than another one, but it grows as tall as it is capable of growing. So he does not judge us one against the other. It is not competition. This world is so full of competition, and we've swallowed the idea so much, it's hard to see it God's way. You hear about a basketball game and you say, well, how much did they beat them? You never hear it. You go, well, how well did they play? No, who won? How badly did Kentucky beat Indiana? Or Ohio State get beat? It was according to their own ability. Then you find verse 16, the one that got 5, he traded. Some people are not traders. They lose their shirt trading in the stock market or other things. Others are. It's just a natural thing for them. They seem to have a sense of trading. My brother-in-law, who's now dead, was dead. He worked for Brown and Root Construction Company for a long time, and finally he decided one day he's going to do what his father had done, and that is be a trader in housing. He made a lot of money. He seemed to have a sense for it. I would have lost my shirt doing what he was doing. He said, trade with these. The one that got 5 traded, he made more. The one that got 2 traded, he got more. The one that got 1, he hid it. Well, he didn't lose it, but he didn't gain anything. He didn't grow. And then God came back to settle the accounts. And that's when it's embarrassing. When God looks us in the eyes and says, okay, I didn't judge you by the other person, so what did you do? He came and settled the accounts. And you will find that this that only got 1 had a bad attitude toward God and toward life and was negative. And he didn't do very well. To prove this particular point about God not judging us in our growth according to what others did, let's look in Matthew 13 and verse 8. Matthew chapter 13 and beginning in verse 8, we read, this is about the sower and the seed falling in particular places. And we know depending on where it falls, it may or may not produce because of rocks and other things. Others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, shall we say, a good crop. Some 100, some 60, and some only 30. Now, you could say, I feel awful. I only had 30 and he had 100. Well, maybe you couldn't make 100. Maybe you made all you could make. And a boy pat on the backside would be given to you no matter what if you did the best you could. That's why I asked the question, how tall can a tree grow? As tall as it can grow. How much can you make? As much as you're able to make. You don't know how much you're able to make, but give it a try. And do those things that you can do. And he said, he who hears, if you got ears, let him hear what has been said about that. Growing. We've heard this one many times, but it is another one of those very, very good ones, and shows the thoughtfulness of God toward us and of his way of encouraging us. In 1 Corinthians 9, and I think I even heard this either before the feast or at the feast. It's one that we use quite often. 1 Corinthians 9, but often it goes over our head or in and out the ear. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24, he said, do you not know, and he was speaking to those in Corinth where they were athletically inclined, do you not know that those who run in a race, all of them run the race, but only one receives the prize? In one sense, that's very unfair. We almost worship the one who wins, and the one that was only 0.1 seconds behind, you forget his name. And yet he did a good job. He did the best he could. He could not. In my day, it was run the 100-yard dash in 10 flat. I never would have gotten 10th place to run the 110 flat. It just was not in my long legs to do. I could run. I did run. I was reasonable in the long run, but not in the quick dash. He said, all run, but only one receives the prize. Well, that's not the way it is in the family of God. All are running, and all will have a prize. Because Paul said, run, and this is talking to Christians, but using athleticism as an example. He's not saying you ought to get into the, you know, run the 26 mile and kill yourself when you know you can't. But he did say, run in such a way that you may obtain it. In other words, even though you won't be number one, run anyway and do the best you can, using running as an analogy, not that this life is just about running. Then he says in verse 25, this sounds a little strange, everyone who competes, and in the world they do compete, but we're not necessarily competing against each other to beat them. We do have to watch our sales. We do have to use business principles. But in our Christian ideology, we should not be doing it just to beat them down. Everyone who competes for the prize is temperate or in control of himself, temperate in his attitudes and actions. And then he said, they do it to obtain a perishable crown. Because they put it on a shelf and some of them don't even see it, and some even sell it afterward because they would like to have the money rather than the prize that they got. But we do it and we never get anything. No, we do it for an imperishable crown. A good life now and a life for all eternity. That's a pretty good offer. And Paul said, I run, not with uncertainty, but I discipline myself. So we are encouraged, all of us, to run in order to obtain. In other words, to be an overcomer. In other words, work at it. Work at it. There are several things that hinder or help our running or our growing or our having goals to improve our lives. The first one is desire. We all know what desire is, and we all experience desire over who knows how many things. Desire is the deep-seated emotional desire to accomplish and to have. Do we really want to have goals and to accomplish things, or is it just a daydream? A daydream. You can sit there on your back looking up, waiting for the heavy walnut to hit you in the head and wake you up, and you may be there for a long time. Desire, do we really want to do it? The second point that helps us or hinders us, how well do you know yourself? Sometimes we don't want to know ourselves. We're afraid to look at ourselves as we are. But it's important to know yourself, myself, yourself. It's especially important if you are a runner. What are you capable of running? Why get into the 100-yard dash if the 100-yard dash is going to kill you? Why get into the 26-mile run if you know you can't do it? Are you capable of doing it? I remember a point about this in YOU Athletics in Indiana a good many years ago. Our younger son David was running in the half-mile race that day, and he... I guess he decided he would run the mile run also. And later, he did. He registered on the spot and ran and did very well. And later I said, why did you decide to run that race when you hadn't signed up to begin with? He said, well, Dad, I walked behind the fellows. I looked at their legs. And I knew I had better legs than they did. Now, he wasn't looking at handsome. He was looking at the muscle and the leg, which is a big thing in being able to run. Do you have the legs for it, the strength and the stamina? And he did well. He knew himself. He knew what he could do. And he looked at the others and knew he could do just as well or better than they did. So he entered, and I don't think he won, but he came in very well. How well do we know ourselves? Maybe it would be time to get acquainted with ourselves and to really know ourselves. We're going to have to sometime before getting into the family of God know ourselves. And a third one that helps us in accomplishing, in this case it doesn't help us, but it is a factor anyway, and that is distractions. Something always gets in the way, and it bothers us, and it distracts us, and we're not able to accomplish what we had in mind to accomplish. In 1 Corinthians 9, verse 26, Paul said this about himself. I run not with uncertainty. I fight not as one who beats the air. I discipline my body and bring it into subjection. He was using again athleticism as an example of Christianity. Maybe we need to discipline ourselves so that we are not distracted. It's easy to sit down, turn on the TV for a moment, and sit there for 2 hours. And watch nothing, really. It's easy to waste the time we could have used in accomplishing something, and we just frittered our time away. Distractions, they're all around us. We're constantly bothered with distractions every day, sometimes all day long. Some people may still feel that it's wrong for Christians to have goals. You don't need goals. We have the kingdom of God. Jesus said, put the kingdom of God first, and that's all you need. Well, it is true we should put the kingdom of God first. But we also have to have goals about handling those things that pertain to our life, which is a part of being in the kingdom of God. They will usually use James 4, beginning in verse 13, to prove that you don't need to have goals, or that it might even be wrong or sinful to have. It would be ungodly to have goals, because then you would be trying to do it on your own rather than trusting in God. So James chapter 4 and verse 13 says, "Come now, you who say, today and tomorrow, we're going to go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. We're going to make a lot of money. Whereas you don't know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? It's like a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away," which is true. "Instead, you ought to say, if it's God's will." Well, if it isn't sinful, anything is God's will, meaning he's not against it if it's right, if it's appropriate. You know that it's okay to do it if it isn't sinful. You ought to say, if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this or that. Now, here's where it shows that some people do not know how to read the Bible. You need to read all of the verses that pertain to it. They stop at verse 15. But if they would read verse 16, it would help them understand why it is wrong for some. It says, "But now you boast in your arrogance." I don't think an arrogant person is going to get into the kingdom of God. And one who is boasting, like Moses, well, Moses will be there, but he paid a price. He said, "Here now, you rebels, must we do this for you?" A little bit of arrogance there and a little bit of boasting. He let it slip there at the last minute, but he paid the price and he will be there. It said, "All such boasting is evil." So it isn't wrong to have goals, but are we arrogant about it? Are we humble in our accomplishments? We should be humble in our accomplishments. Is it wrong to have goals? God has goals. He has a plan. He has goals. He has a first resurrection. That's a goal that he will be working toward to accomplish for all of mankind. Well, not all, but a big part. Second resurrection. What do you do with those that are not good enough to make it, but not bad enough to miss it? He has a second resurrection. And that's a marvelous thing and shows the tremendous love that God has for mankind and womankind. And then there's a third resurrection where they are bitter, resentful, hostile. They don't want to change. They never will change. And they'd just be a mess if they were left there in the midst of everybody. So they're just burned up, gotten rid of, and they're not there. That is a goal. I hate to think of that, but it's listed in the Bible. He lays out plans and he brings them to pass. God has goals. He accomplishes his goals. They're wonderful goals. They add to the lives of people. We're told to be like God, planning and accomplishing. Would you believe that Jesus had goals also? Do you think you could find the places where it talked about the goals that Jesus had? Let's look in Luke 12, verse 50. Luke 12 and verse 50. Jesus was talking here about the life that he lived and a particular thing that would be in his life that he wasn't awfully fond of in one sense. Not that he didn't. Well, let's just read it. Luke 12. And verse 50. It starts in verse 42. The Lord said, "Who then is that faithful and wise steward whom his master will make ruler over his household to give him their portion in due season?" And it goes, and in the Bible I have, it's all red letter, and you come on down to verse 50, he was talking to them and he just relayed to them about himself. He said, "I have a baptism to be baptized with." Now, he'd already been baptized by John the Baptist, but He was talking about the baptism of death, the way he would die. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how distressed I am till it is accomplished. He had that on his mind often, I'm sure. The end of his life, humanly speaking. It was his responsibility to die for mankind. Nobody else could. Obviously, he was distressed, but he wasn't distressed to the point of giving up. He knew that he had to do it, and he was willing to do it. Sometimes the things we know we should do, when we don't want to do, we don't do, and things get bad. But better would be that we know we should do it, and we do it, even though, humanly speaking, we don't like it. But we know that it will be good for all others and for ourselves later. His goal was to finish that baptism, because he knew if he didn't, he would disappoint his father, and mankind would not be his brothers and sisters in the family of God. Now, in John 17, you'll find one other place where he talked about his goal. John 17, and we will read in verse 1. John 17, Jesus spoke these words, lifted up his eyes to heaven, so he was praying, and he said, Father, it's here. All that we have discussed long ago has now come. The hour has come. Glorify your Son, that your Son may also glorify you. He was asking that the goal they had set for him be fulfilled, and in doing so, that he would glorify his Father in heaven. Then in verse 4, I have glorified you on the earth. And then he said, I have finished the work which you gave me to do. So his goal was to do a certain work. It wasn't to save the world then. It was to prepare the men to be apostles and to fulfill what was given him to do in dying for mankind. Only he could do it, and he did it. Although he did say, is there any other way? Well, all right, then I will do that. He had a goal. Maybe he was, for a fleeting instant, who knows? It's only speculation. That he said, I wonder what happened if I don't. Well, he knew what would happen, and he determined to go ahead and finish it. And he said to the Father in a prayer, I have finished the work which you gave me to do. He was held responsible for something. There was a goal being held over his head that he had to do, and he did it. Goals are important in life. They tell us where we're going. So, let's take a look at some of the things that you might want to put on your list. Not your January 1 list while you're drinking under the mistletoe, but your day after the Feast of Tabernacles when you come back home tired, broke, but happy. And you think, I don't want to do this coming year. What about what was given in the sermonette? Teach our children the Bible about life. That's a goal for all of us. We have grandchildren. Sometimes we like to, browbeat them into the Bible and other things, but teaching is different. It takes a certain something to be a good teacher. Teach our children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren about the principles of life, or shall we say the living laws of life that will affect their life whether they believe in it or not. It really will. What about as a goal, some form of exercise on a semi-regular basis? Boy, you're quiet on that one. I am too. It would be easier to sit in a chair, have a beer, and watch TV rather than exercising. But exercise makes the blood flow a little better, and blood flowing properly helps the body. How about reading one book a month, whether audio reading or just reading the book itself? They say that readers become leaders. Those that don't read are not filling their minds sometimes appropriately. How about the goal of monitoring your TV watching? We all know there's trash on TV, and sometimes we watch the trash. What if while we're watching trash TV, we finish eating whatever we're finishing, take it over to the garbage pail underneath the sink, and we look in there, and there's a lot of garbage there, a lot of trash there, and we look at that and think about what we're watching. How about also a goal of reading through the Bible in a year? Sometimes if we haven't read the Bible, we don't know if the Bible says it or not. But if you've read it, you can say, I don't care what you say, I know because I read it with my own eyes. So just reading the Bible through. Another goal is to read the Bible more regularly, even if it's only 5 minutes every day. Regularly filling one's mind with God's truth. How about fasting on days other than just the Day of Atonement? Fasting is what can help us to be humble toward God. Another one, and I found that it was very helpful in Jekyll, a goal of managing your money better, to get out of debt, to save, to make life more enjoyable with the managing of your money properly. That's a good goal, and it will help you and your children and your wife and your children. Now there's another one, and I hope you won't take this as my whacking on the wife or the cook of the family. How about learning to cook better for the family? We are what we eat, and we eat what's cooked and set before us. And if it's not done very well, and it's not very good food, well, we have conditions we really don't want. Learning to cook better for the sake of the whole family. We are the sum total of what we have eaten and are eating. That's one of those living laws, too. Here's another one that's important. I've heard in other areas, and I hear here, that Columbus is a very good church, that there are a lot of good servants in Columbus. And I believe that. I believed it years ago when we were here. I don't know what it is. But I do believe that there are pillars in the Church of God in Columbus. And you know what a pillar is? It helps support the building, to keep the building from falling in and destroying itself. Pillars are needed. They don't say much. In fact, a pillar doesn't say anything. It just stands there and holds the building and supports the whole thing. How about as a goal to become a pillar in the church? If not here, wherever you are. That would have a reward forever in the kingdom of God. To determine, to make it a point in your life to become a pillar. You know the truth, you're convinced of the truth, you can explain the truth. The truth is what you are. Another one is, and here again, treading on ice. How about if you're married, a man married? Well, I shouldn't have put it that way, but you... How about the goal of being a better husband better husband. Maybe you're a good husband, but a better one. To improve in being a very, very good husband as God intends us to be. One of the problems of Israel was the lack of leaders. One of the problems of families is the lack at times of a leader, the lack of a husband who will take the lead. I was talking about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and Jekyll on one of the sermons, and I mentioned, you know, Eve could determine just by looking at it that it was good. Good for food, good for whatever. And she took of it, ate it, handed it to her husband and said, "Here, honey, take some of this." And he said, "Okay, honey, if that's what you want, well, whatever you say, that's what I'll do." And that's what he did. He took it. He didn't even question it. And I noticed as I was saying there was quite a few women in the front row laughing. They weren't laughing at me. They were laughing at what I said because they had seen that in their life. And it is funny, but it ain't funny. And yet that is a weakness of every one of us as a man. We have to learn to be a better husband, a strong leader without being a dictator. Now, on the other side of that coin is, what about a goal of being a better wife? You've all read, and some say, "I don't want to hear that again, Proverbs 31, the wife. I don't want to hear that again at all." It's a wonderful chapter. It shows what a woman is capable of doing. I mean, it appears to say that the husband is down at the center of town playing checkers and talking with all the other men, but he was a leader of the community. He made decisions and he helped the city to do well. The wife, it said, his heart trusted in her. He wasn't afraid of anything. Often we want to say that, you know, that's talking about sexuality. He trusted her sexually. It isn't talking about that at all. It is talking about that she bought a farm, she bought land her own, didn't even ask him, and said he completely trusted her in what she did. She takes care of the family. She builds the family. She adds a lot to the family. And yet the husband wasn't just some weak one out there doing nothing. He was leading. And so being a better wife, that's a goal. And those are ideas to think about when you're thinking about a goal. A goal should be something that you feel comfortable in accomplishing. If you say, "Well, in this next year, I want to be a millionaire." Okay, fine, but is it practical? You think you're going to do that? Start with something you can do. And we can all do a lot of these that have been mentioned. Have you ever heard the point that half the fun is in the chase? Half the fun is in the chase. I don't understand the Englishmen. They get on these beautiful horses. They dress up in their uniforms. They have their hounds there. And then they chase the fox. That poor little fox running all over the countryside. And as soon as they catch him, they throw him away. You know, they're just chasing the fox. Half the fun is in the chase. Life is a run, in a sense, and it ought to have some fun. Half the fun is in the chase. Have you ever heard the one, the road? The one on you're traveling on is better than the inn. In a way, we're always happier going to the place after we've gotten there and head home. A lot of fun. The road is better than the inn. Have you heard the one, life is in the living? That is the lifestyle that we have and we're participating in. And the last one, it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. Now, we don't want to lose in a sense, but we do want to play the game right, enjoy the game, and develop in the game itself. Why do I say all these things? Because life is a journey. Life is a journey. And conversion is a process. a process that leads to a life, a good life now, and a life that will never, ever, ever end. God intended that we enjoy that process. As I said in the beginning, it has been estimated, and we don't know the exact number, but 5% of people have goals. That means 95% don't. It also means that only 5% are actively guiding their lives. They're just letting it flow, and they take whatever comes their way. 95% are just idling their engines, wondering why they aren't going anywhere and why they aren't accomplishing. As I said also, goals focus our attention on specifics. You know, we get upset sometimes when people are trying to tell us something. We say, well be more specific. Be more specific. That applies to life. By continually focusing our attention on a specific activity, we have more of a chance of accomplishing that activity. God encourages us, even admonishes us in goal setting and accomplishment on a large scale. You'll find this in Proverbs 24 and verse 27. But for many, it's just a religious proverb, nice little saying, but you know, we got to get back to life. Well, if people followed this, they wouldn't start off on the wrong foot and wind up having a bad marriage and a bad life. Proverbs 24 and verse 27. Prepare your work outside, or prepare your outside work. Make it fit for yourself in the field, speaking agriculturally, farming. In other words, have a farm, work the farm, have an income, and afterward, build your big, beautiful home. Many today have lived in a nice home with their parents, and they expect that's what they'll always have. They go to college, or maybe they get married and don't go to college, and then they want to build a home or buy a home, and they put it on credit. 30-year mortgage, which is front-loaded, and it takes 21 years for them to get the mortgage amount down to equal the principal amount down to the interest amount, and they wonder why they don't have any extra money. This is talking about priorities. It is talking about goals. In other words, and this is where the Jews have the advantage over many people because, and you know, Paul was an apostle, but he also had a job. Now, he didn't do it because he shouldn't be getting tithe. He did it because that was probably what was taught to him as a youth, that they taught him to be qualified to have a job. But in the case that he was talking about, he didn't want the Corinthians to say, oh, well, yeah, you just took our money. He was willing to work. The point being, we should be able to have a job that is a career and then get married and build a house and be able to afford it, not paying everything on interest for 40 years. Often it is done backwards. And I don't mean that if they do that, they're evil. I'm just saying the laws of God will help us have a better life. And if we follow them as guides, as goals, then our life will be much, much better. Many of us can't do much about it right now because that was in the past. But we could do it for our children. We could help our children and, of course, our grandchildren. That one is a very, very powerful one. Proverbs 29:18-19 says, where there's no vision, there's nothing specific in the future, perish. Or they may have embarrassing circumstances. But happy are those that keep the law because it is a codified outline of activity. And Proverbs 13, verse 19 says, the desire accomplished is sweet to the soul. As I said in the beginning, if you go to the garage, get in the car, put the key in the ignition, start the car, put it in reverse, rev up the engine, and take your hands off, what do you think is going to happen? You won't like what's happening. And the reason is there's nobody guiding the activity. In life, we have to guide our activities. Sometimes that takes setting some goals out there that we strive to accomplish, goals that are good, not just to be arrogant about it, but to try and build a better life. The year will come and go. You can bet on that, if anybody would bet on it with you. It will come, it will go, whether we accomplish or not. Be one of the 5%. Only 5%, they say, have goals. Be one. Why not? Why not be one of the 5%? If you do, life will never be the same from then on.